Every language is a system, all of whose parts interrelate and interact organically. Georg von der Gabelitz. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank everyone for joining me this week, especially all our new listeners, and there does seem to be quite a few. I hope you're joining us in the newer episodes and are going back and listening, but May is off to a scorching start. I think it's very easily going to break my total downloads in a month. We're already halfway there with only about... Well, only one real episode put out, and we still got a couple of more left. So, thank you for your support. And if you're listening on any platform, please rate, subscribe, all that kind of good stuff. So, let's go ahead and get into it. And again, I appreciate everyone's support, new listeners, old listeners, all you guys. Thank you, thank you, thank you. So, this week we will be finishing up our coverage of West Africa for the season, and this will be a shorter episode to cap a short section of the season. I know that might be frustrating to some, but because of the Saharan desiccation that's happening, it's hard to find a lot of firm archaeological materials. And we're having to make more guesses and suppositions. But starting next season, we will have more firm information to go into. And of course, there's always the chance, new discoveries will be made. We'll be talking about one of the more recent discoveries that happened, at least one of the sites. And I know I've mentioned it before. I believe I mentioned it last season. We were talking about West Africa. So who knows? We may find something like that later. So, that said, it's important to remember that the peoples of West Africa, and indeed people everywhere, generally have more technology than what their artifacts indicate. And even in a situation where you can't find any artifacts, you know that obviously they're Homo sapiens, they're very, creative and intelligent, they have... of course, very long experience living in the area, so they know, in general, how to survive. They, of course, know what they need to live and how to get it. They just need to find the sources and develop them. Now, we talked about last season how it is very likely that West Africans or their ancestors living in the Sahara had independently developed pottery. They were also probably well on their way to domesticating plants and possibly some animals as well, much like the peoples in the Middle East and East Asia. However, as the Sahara was beginning to dry, these people were probably hampered in the development of these advancements and their spread. They're, of course, too useful to be forgotten or abandoned, but the region was becoming less and less conducive for experimentation and innovation, and just probably for large-scale planting when it comes to agriculture. This is why I believe that the peoples who are spreading into West Africa see a delay in them finalizing their adoption, I guess if you want to call it that. It's obviously not a formal adoption, but they aren't able to sit to stay sedentary and begin to practice true agriculture yet. They're still at that kind of mix of rough horticulture and proto-agriculture. And of course, they're because they can't stay in any one place for too long, this is preventing them from making more varied pottery and ceramics. Are probably just using very simple, easy to carry designs, and of course, generally, as people are in one place longer and they have more and more free time, that agriculture helps to provide. They begin to change up how they create pottery, and both in terms of shapes of vessels and they may not even be making vessels at that point. They could be making certain types of ornamentation or statues or little votive figures or whatever. Art isn't developing as much in much the same way as just, practical application. They've just been practicing their known traditional forms of art. However, there is one craft that they're continuing to hone and develop, even as the ever-expanding desert and drier environment causes them to search farther and wider for more welcoming and supportive lands, that being textile, cloth, or leather production, whatever you want to call it. Now, West Africa is going to become a major axis of this type of activity, with every sizable group, and even in some cases, smaller groups, eventually developing their own styles, where they specialize in their own favorite materials, their process of refining those materials, and colors as well. And in some cases, people in the same ethnic groups end up having wildly different dress than their cousins. Excuse me. Now, I need to be clear, national and ethnic costumes are not uniquely West African. But in terms of population density, the region sees much more dynamic differences as opposed to, say, someone living in Germany and someone living in France. Obviously, there are, seasonal differences that you got to take into account, but by and large, most European clothes, generally, there's periods where certain styles are more popular than others, even if they're not made by the same people, they are at least trying to copy neighbors. And that's same is true in East Asia as well. And whereas in West Africa, it seems, and this may be me projecting a little, but it seems like all these people have a little bit more, pride in their national dress or their ethnic dress. Now, part of that is because whereas Europe and East Asia develop, you'd call them more industrial type production methods. And again, that's probably not a very accurate word. Whereas West Africa, it's something that's done more in a smaller home or maybe village setting, where it's someone, it's a group of people who are practicing traditions that have been passed on to them, so they take pride in those traditions. Whereas that's maybe not the case in certain other places in the world. Now, I will say it is hard to say when this development happens for sure. But I think as proto-agriculture is becoming more important again this season, which is towards the end, and peoples are moving into and through West Africa, and they're encountering more varied climates, they're probably developing more varied dress and accessories. They may not changing their clothes too much, but they may be making cloaks or different types of shoes or hats or things like that. So that's important to take into account as well. Now, going back to a little bit of our discussion last week about the languages in the Niger-Congo family, I want to turn to a few of the smaller languages in that family. Now, of course, last episode I talked about the Mande languages and how they kind of looks like, it appears at least, that they were possibly pushed south by the desertification of the Sahara, and they kind of split more widely accepted, or at least accepted is not the right word. They kind of split more branches of the Niger-Congo family that show more explicit similarities. I think that might be the best way. That the languages that split are more firmly rooted together as being part of the Niger-Congo. Mande, of course, being a little bit unique the Mande family having a little bit more uniqueness to it than the other Niger-Congo languages. And of course, again, we've talked about it, that there is some debate as to whether or not it should be included at all, but we're not going to go into that anymore because, by and large, it is, in most people's estimation, included. Now, of course, I talked about how it was definitely a language at this point, Niger-Congo, I mean, and that it had probably begun to split as the spread of agriculture begins to take root. Different regions will develop, of course, their own crops, their own methods for growing these crops. So that's where you begin to see more diversification in the languages, which, of course, gives rise to different branches of the family. Now you have the Atlantic portion of the Atlantic Congo, which is the biggest sub-family of the Niger-Congo family. The Atlantic languages are almost all along the, of course, the Atlantic coast of West Africa. And then, of course, you have the Mande that kind of separate the Atlantic languages, for the most part, from the other parts of the Atlantic Congo family. We'll talk about some of those other branches next season because they're more likely to have developed by that point. But there are a couple of smaller potential branches that are included in Niger-Congo, or at least most of the scholars, from what I've read, will include at least one or two of these languages, if not all of them. Or they may kind of rearrange them in terms of where they would be in the tree. Or, again, debate whether they belong on the tree at all. But one of those, subfamilies is the Ijaw languages, or the Ijo languages. And this is one of those that is a little controversial. I think some of the more recent classifications are some of the more recent linguists working with this group are less prosaic, maybe is the right word, about the inclusion of the family in the Niger-Congo tree. But I know Joseph Greenberg, who I believe I talked about last season, I know I've mentioned him before. He's, of course, one of the more influential linguists in the last half of the 20th century. He thought that Izon did belong in the Niger-Congo family, but that it was a very old branch, and it probably broke off very early. Now, of course, the other people talking about the language think that they could have just been a neighbor, or their, I guess, the proto-Izon language speakers were neighbors of the proto-Niger-Congo speakers, and that's why they have these very small similarities. That is, of course, debated. Now, these people mostly live in what is now southern Nigeria, so they do not make up by any stretch of the imagination a very large ethnic group. But it is possible that they may, again, be one of the first groups to move in. They may have been traveling kind of similar routes as Niger Congo speakers. They're the proto Niger Congo speakers. They're moving into the region. If they were not related ethnically or linguistically, they may have been moving into the region for the same reasons as the proto Niger Congo speakers. These people's ancestors, or I guess the modern Ijaw people, do have fairly significant population clusters in parts of the Niger River Delta, where it begins to spread out. And they have some other places, too. I think they have some in places like Gabon, Sierra Leone, where they are fishermen, which shouldn't be too surprising. Again, they lived in the Niger River Delta. That's, of course, where the river empties out to the sea. A lot of good fishing in the area, marshes, places like that, where they could live. Now, the Ijaw, or Izen, depending on, again, what source you're reading. I think the endonym they use is Izon. Now, I've read a couple of things online. There are some vastly different dates. Some say that they have lived in the Niger Delta region since before, like, 5000 BC. So, right around the start of this season. Now, I could not find any firm sources on that. It's kind of like their own story. There's not a lot of archaeological evidence, I think, that just confirms that, oh yeah, the people living here at this time are definitely Izon. But they're definitely related to them. Now, how closely is a matter of debate. I don't think we know for sure that these are Izon people, but they do emerge very early. And because of where they live, they're able to kind of retain their identity and their language a lot more than other groups further inland, where they have, like, these larger, more agricultural-focused groups kind of move in or expand into other regions. But possibly their people are living in the area at this point in the season. Around 5000 BC. So about 1,000 years after the season starts. That is a possibility. And despite the lack of sources, again, their oral history and traditions should have some weight, if nothing else. Rivers do factor kind of into their traditions. They are very much considered themselves a river people. Though some of their claims, or at least I don't know if it's their claims or claims that certain people make about them, claim that they immigrated from the Nile Valley during antiquity, which kind of doesn't make sense if they are one of the more ancient peoples in Nigeria, which that's kind of one of the things that, you know, is debated internally in Nigeria, who's the oldest group of people in the area. Now, it could be possible that very ancient ancestors of the Ijaw moved from the southern portion of the Nile, or maybe the Lake Chad region, during a period where, you know, during an even earlier period. If that's the case, though, they're not part of the Nile civilization. Though, they may be related to people who were part of the Nile Valley civilization. I don't think they would have made that long of a trip that recently, especially if, as their own traditions state, they have been in the region since around 5,000 years ago. If they were in the Nile Valley or around Lake Chad, It's well before any type of Neolithic or proto-Neolithic events are happening, in my opinion. But that's not to say they aren't related to some people that were there. Very distantly, of course. So that's kind of the Ijaw, or the Izo. Izon. And again, we'll talk about them a little bit more detail next season, because while I may not be 100% convinced of the 8000 BC, I definitely think that they're there by the end of next season. At least, now, whether or not they're referring to themselves as the Izon at that point, that's something we'll dive into. But we will talk more about these people next season. Now, the next kind of smaller branch, and yeah, that's not to be pejorative, that we should talk about in the Niger-Congo family is the Dogon languages. There are about 600,000 speakers of Dogon today, and they have like around a dozen to 14 or so dialects of Dogon. And they're kind of the most, I guess you call them kind of the most northerly kind of sub-branch. And it's not very widespread. They are surrounded kind of on all sides by Mande or Atlantic Congo speakers. But they're occupying a region that is a little harder to get to. It's fairly isolated. This is kind of like a plateau region of what is now Mali. It's kind of south of where the Niger River bends towards the sea. And they have, while they may only have like around 600,000 or so speakers, there are maybe as possibly as many as a million of these Dogon peoples today, maybe a little bit more. It's hard to say. I think, now, those are older numbers. The only official count I was able to find for them was from 10 years or so ago. It could be a lot more today. I don't think the Dogon are experiencing, you know, a lot of, or at least any more turmoil than any other people in the region. Now, these people, it's kind of hard to get a firm date on when they're entering where they live now. Their oral traditions do have, do claim that they lived alongside the Mande for quite some time. And eventually they left once the Mande began to persecute them for their religious beliefs. Now, this does not happen until, you know, later, well after Islam arrives to the area. So they have their own language. It's a very old language from what we can tell. It is possibly related to the Mande branch of the Niger-Congo, or it could have just been because they were neighbors so long with the Mande and the other parts of the Atlantic part of the Niger-Congo family. They just kind of adopted certain terms and other parts of their languages. So they were living somewhere where the Mande lived. However, where they're going to move now, or where they live now, is very concentrated. All the Mande, or excuse me, all the Dogon peoples are, you know, fairly compact in their kind of region. And they're, again, surrounded on all sides by other, you know, ethnic and linguistic groups. But their language is different from the Mande. It's different enough that it may not even be Niger-Congo. Again, it's debated. So they're very old people. They were probably living in the area at least as long as the Mande were. if not maybe a little bit earlier, maybe a century or two later. It's hard to say. They have kept their identity intact, their own kind of culture alive. The Dogon people exist, or at least their ancestors do. What they called themselves at that point, it's hard to say. I would like to go more into their religious stuff, but again, a lot of their modern day religion is based off of their story of migration away from the Mande, which doesn't happen until the historical period where we have really good records, and again after Islam arrives to the area, so that's quite a ways. But we can make some guesses about their early religion. They are ancestor worshippers. Part of their migration story involves them obtaining the bones of a very venerated ancestor and a hero. His name is Lebe. I say part of their migration story is trying to obtain those bones. I'm not going to go, again, into the details on that story till later, but he is kind of the he is the progenitor of their race. He is the father of the two sons who followed, fathered the tribes of the Dogon. So he is the grandfather, essentially, of all the Dogon. Now, they also have gods that they worship as well. Now, those I will mention a little bit more here and now. Their creator god is known as Ama. And this is not... He is not a unique deity to them. There are several West and, I think, some North African religious traditions where there is a god referred to as Ama. So this could be a very old religion for the region and probably the world as well. Of course, we went into detail on Kagan for the San peoples, but this is a... Ama's a little bit different, well, very different than Kagan, whereas Kagan's kind of a trickster creator. Ama is not. Ama is a sky god, or at least he's usually considered a sky god. He is also, while he is referred to as he by most, he is somewhat androgynous or hermaphroditic, depending on the group that's more emphasized by other peoples than by some people and de-emphasized by others. But he kind of is very involved in biological creation, so he in some ways has both male and female reproductive powers. Again, he's a sky god. He is the creator of the universe, at least in... I'm pretty sure he's considered the creator in all of the pantheons where he was a part of, but for the Dogon, they do see him definitively as the creator of the universe. And he essentially created kind of the unformed universe, was kind of in an egg, and it had that egg had like the seeds and everything that you would need to create life from. It's an egg, but at least according to the Encyclopedia Britannica entry on the egg, it was actually more conical and maybe kind of like a weird quadrangle base with kind of a conical top. The corners of the base are, of course, the cardinal directions. Depending on the group of Dogon telling the myth, something caused this egg to hatch. It's not specifically mentioned that Ama tried to make it hatch. It just the egg hatched itself, maybe, or possibly Amma did plan for it to hatch at an appointed time. It's hard to say for sure. Anyway, when the egg hatched, it kind of spit everything out, or kind of flung everything out, and this is kind of related to the stars filling the sky, the earth forming, the sun forming, the moon forming. And in fact, I think, again, one of the articles I read specifically equated it kind of with how when you spin a pot, like clay kind of flies off, and, you know, as you're like working it, it kind of gets flung everywhere. And then the Dogon refer to the sun kind of as being kind of like a clay pot fired at the highest heat possible. Now, creating the universe is just his first act. He is also credited with having created life. Amma impregnates the earth like a male figure at this point, whereas before he, of course, laid an egg like a chicken or a female fowl of some type. But at this point, where he's creating life, he is a masculine figure at this point. Now, the first creature that was born from the earth was not what Amma had intended or wanted. This creature is a jackal. And the jackal is kind of seen as an affront to the natural order of the world, and they're kind of creatures of chaos and disorder. So that's why the jackal is very much shunned by Dogon society, and a lot of African societies really hate jackals for reasons we can talk about later. But yeah, so that is kind of the first attempt of Amma creating life. Eventually, though, he does get it correct, and he fertilizes the earth, and that produces a kind of a group of twins called the Nomo. Nomos is the Dogon word for to make someone drink. And the Nomo are kind of described as amphibious, fish-esque mer people, I guess, for lack of a better term. There are some depictions where they say they're like their lower half is kind of green and scaly, like a fish or maybe a snake, and then their upper half is more humanoid. But because their lower half is non-human, they are also, like Amma, fairly hermaphroditic. Or they can be one sex or the other, or what have you. Now, depending on the version of the story being told, Nomo may have been one person that then split into four pairs of twins, or it may have been a pair of twins that then doubled themselves to become, essentially like creating another group of twins from their union. But anyway, that's one of the regional variations, or depending on the tribe telling the story, they have a different kind of concept of the genesis of their people. And Bonomo are the ancestors of the Dogon people. And Lebe, the Dogon ancestor, who was, key to the founding of the Dogon people, he is one of their descendants. Now, I couldn't find a firm story on if he was a part of the, or if he was a direct descendant of the Nomo twins, or if he came along much later. I couldn't get a firm answer on that. So I don't know. I don't think it matters to the Dogon, or, the point is, Lebe is a descendant of the first peoples. Now, the Nomo one of the Minomo, at least, rebels eventually against Amma and his creations. So to kind of restore cosmic order, Amma has to sacrifice more of the Nomo. Again, depending on when the story is told and by whom, the Nomo that was sacrificed, or it may have been two Nomo sacrificed to restore order, created water reservoirs and rivers and things like that to help sustain people. Some of the Nomo may have had their bodies divided so that it would feed men and allow them to drink. The Nomo are, as you might guess, kind of river spirits or deities to an extent. They're not meant to be a specific river, but their blood and their essence is what gives humans, or what allows food and water to be produced for humans to consume. Sorry, I was listening to a motorcycle just blare down the road here. There are also places where the Dogon in their current territory believe that parts of the Nomo bodies landed during this sacrificial act, and they build shrines there to kind of worship at. Nomo, very important, probably more important to the day-to-day life of the Dogon than the Amma, though, of course, probably none of these deities are probably as important as their later ancestor, direct ancestor, Lebe. I think that's a good place to kind of call it. I'm glad we got to cover, at least in general, some mythology again. I would like to go into a little bit more detail on that, but as I said, Amma is kind of an older deity, and I would like to cover it, but I kind of want to get to a point where we can firmly establish identities for certain people. It's only because the Dogon themselves are... there is just one Dogon group. There is not... there's only... not one Dogon group. Again, there's dozens of them, or a dozen or so of them. But they all have the same language, whereas the Mande people, or the Mande language, is broken up into a little bit more distinct ethnic groups. They might understand each other to an extent, but they all have their own traditions that are different from each other, whereas the Dogon more or less have a very monolithic religious tradition. So I would like to talk a little bit more about it, but I kind of want to get till we have firm evidence of a specific ethnic or tribal group before I dive too heavily into their mythology, just to kind of keep things balanced and even. But we will, I'm sure, return to Amma with some more people later and go into a little bit more detail on some other West African religions at a later time. I do need to also refer to the Kordofanian languages. These are probably the ones that are most doubted in terms of Niger-Congo languages. They're kind of an isolate. They are much further east than any of the other Niger-Congo languages, and also they're among the more northerly ones as well. They are actually very close to the kind of the Nile River system, and there's a big gap between them and other Niger-Congo-speaking peoples. They are surrounded by Nilo-Saharan speakers, Sudanese speakers, and Afro-Asiatic speakers to their north and east. And because Cordofanian is so kind of doubted, and it's very probable that these people may not even be in the area yet, it's hard to kind of get a firm grasp on them. And there are not that many Cordofanian speakers today. I think there's at most maybe 500,000. And that's spread along, three or four branches, maybe even five, depending on whose interpretation of the language you take into account, too. And again, if they exist, their identity, the proto-Cordofanian, if it exists, isn't enough to talk about, because it may not exist. These could all be just separate languages that form different groups, and they may not even exist until next season anyway, as independent branches of the Niger-Congo family. If, again, they are even Niger-Congo, which that's debated. So we'll probably deal with more with these peoples next season, maybe even the season after. I'll have to double-check my notes on that, but yeah. Thank you all for listening. I hope you've enjoyed. I hope you liked the Dogon creation myth. And I hope that you will look forward to more discussions of Dogon mythology as we get to it, which, again, with the arrival of Islam in the region, we've got quite a ways to go. But I'm sure we'll talk about the Dogon religion more in the meantime, or at least about Amma in the meantime. But yeah, please feel free to give me any constructive criticism or feedback at waradrefpod@gmail.com. You can contact me via direct message on X or Twitter, whichever you want to call it. You can comment on any of the YouTube uploads I make. I upload these episodes audio only on YouTube weekly. They go up at the same time as Spotify, and I try to include the link to the YouTube episode on the RSS feed. So whenever it loads up on whatever website, Spotify, Apple, wherever you're listening, I think you should have the YouTube link as well. But you can also drop in when I live stream on YouTube, which is usually Monday through Thursday, and occasionally some on the weekends. I've been playing as the Inca in Europa Universalis 4. We're going to try and expand some into Mesoamerica, and then hopefully kick out the Europeans from South America to get the achievements for that. Making very good progress so far, and it's been a very fun run. So I hope to see some of you there, if not all of you. And yeah, please feel free to contact me. Please subscribe, like, all that kind of good stuff, wherever you can, whenever you can. I really appreciate it. Thank you all. I'll see y'all next time. You all have a good day and a good week. Peace.